Please silence all electronic devices.
As Becky said many times, the most important thing that our state does, our state government, the thing it spends the most money on is our public education system. This is an untenable situation in the long run, and yet we don't really have any other options.
There's even a Broadway producer who has given money to the Roy Cooper campaign. And so I think that speaks to the national interest in North Carolina.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Bunker of Sweatshirts, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad to have you along. As always, a big thanks as well to my colleague Will Michaels, who did his best to wrangle Becky and Rob last week. And really, that's all we can do, right? We can wrangle Becky and Rob as best we can. So here, of course, without further ado, are Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the progressive NC Policy Watch. Good to be back with you.
Good to be back
with
you. Hey,
guys.
Socially distanced recording Friday morning. K-12 public schools will not open as normal next month. Governor Roy Cooper announced Plan B this week. It's a hybrid plan of some in-person learning coupled with virtual education. Details are largely being left up to local school districts, which can move to entirely online learning if they so choose. Already, some of the largest districts in the state are indeed doing that, moving to all remote classes. And the High School Athletic Association has delayed sports until at least September 1st. Becky, is there anything the governor and or these local school boards should have done differently?
Gosh, you know, in this crisis time, that I think there's always going to be room to say, well, you know, shoulda, coulda, woulda. I was disappointed, number one, that we didn't start this earlier. Now, I understand that, you know, we're watching the numbers and to see how this thing develops and it changes, and so the governor felt like more time was needed. But I was disappointed that there wasn't more time for parents and school systems to work through some of these things. I also was a little bit disappointed in what the governor ended up doing was really just kind of throwing things out there and telling the individual school districts, you know, here, you figure it out. It didn't seem to be much of a plan coming from the governor. It's left the school systems really scrambling. What we've even seen this week is, you know, Wake County, for example, had started the week under one plan. Parents were and teachers were beginning to make plans and get things in order in one direction. Now we're seeing that it looks like we're going to go in a little bit different direction. So there just seems to be a lot of confusion, a lot of scrambling here at the last minute to figure all this out. And, you know, what the long-term effects or how this is, we'll see in the coming weeks, and then probably, you know, by the end of the semester, looking back at this, we'll see where those decisions should have and could have been different. But for right now, it just seems like it's a big confusing mess that everybody's left just kind of hanging and really scrambling to make whatever arrangements are necessary depending on what your school district did.
Well, as we've talked about before, this is an impossible situation, and nobody would want to have to make the decision that the governor and others are having to make here, local school boards, my goodness. It's about the best you can come up with. I think we've all foreseen for quite some time that we're going to some sort of a hybrid plan. It's leaving. If the governor had not ceded a lot of control to local school districts, he'd be getting pilloried right now for not doing that. He's in an impossible situation. I think he chose the best path, a lot of, you know, sort of providing a framework, but leaving a lot of discretion to local folks, to local parents. And here's the reality. One of the reasons, of course, he waited was because this is such a rapidly changing situation, and it's going to change again, no doubt. We're going to have changes. School districts are going to make decisions, and then they're going to have outbreaks. And it's easy to talk right now about how, kids don't spread this very much, and, you know, they don't get sick. And as soon as one does, or a beloved teacher in a school system gets sick from this virus, it's going to be a very different conversation when the reality strikes. So I think we're heading to a lot of online education. I have a lot of concerns about that because I don't think we've invested adequate resources to make that truly available in lots of digital divide areas of the state where we don't have good internet, a lot of families who are of low income. They're the folks who need this the most because their parents don't have the option of teaching their kids at home. We've got a lot of stuff to work through. I think the governor made the best of an almost impossible situation.
So let me jump in and ask you about unanswered questions, because I think as we're all in agreement here, this is an incredibly difficult and an incredibly layered, and it's not uniform, right? I mean, Wake County schools are going to be largely different than Terrell County schools, for example, to note one rural locality. There wasn't a plan that I heard, specific protocols for if and when an educator or a student tests positive. What if there's an outbreak? You know, what kinds of flexibility will be given to educators? I guess that's being granted to the local boards as well. One of the things I thought about, not to be overly sinister, is what if a school district just decides to open at full capacity? Think a smaller rural Republican school board. Who's going to challenge that? Who would stop that, if anyone? My question with that as the backdrop is, what's the biggest unanswered question for K through 12 public schools moving forward?
Well, I mean, the big question is, how long is this going to last and where do we go? I mean, obviously, this is creating a huge problem for our children. There's a huge brain drain taking place. This is not the way that we want to run public schools in our state. This is as Becky said many times, the most important thing that our state does, our state government, the thing it spends the most money on is our public education system. This is an untenable situation in the long run, and yet we don't really have any other options. We're not going to put our children and their teachers at even more risk. And I think that if we did get to a situation where a school district has an outbreak, or we have a school district that's simply defying the rules, I think we're going to have some additional action. I think, you know, public health officials are going to play a role in making these decisions too, if you have an outbreak. And we've seen incidents around the state where private businesses have tried to defy state orders, and hopefully that would not happen. But if it did, I think I could foresee a court stepping in and telling them to stop. So it's going to be something we're going to have to remain flexible. It's going to change as we go forward. But the big question is, you know, how do we ride this out, and how long will it go? Will it go throughout the entire school year? I mean, that absent the arrival of some sort of a useful vaccination, that seems like a possibility.
Yeah, I agree with Rob. I mean, you know, the biggest unanswered question is, you know, what direction is this virus going to take, and how long are we going to be here, and what does the next phase of all of this look like moving into the fall? You know, some of the health experts have said, you know, there may be a second wave. We just don't know so much about what is in front of us, which makes this decision even harder to make. You know, if we had those answers and could say, okay, we'll do this for 6 weeks and then we'll move into this for another 6 weeks, but we don't know that. I think some of the questions as we initially are working through this has been, Jeff, to some of those questions that you've raised. You know, what do we do if a teacher comes down and an entire class, or if it's a situation in a high school where it's not just one class of 25 kids, but it's 200 students who have been in front of that teacher for a particular class? What do we do in that case? So I think this is very challenging. And one of the things, again, the unanswered question that we will know is to really monitor this carefully, to assess the kids' learning through this time period. You know, we already have almost one whole semester under our belt with this. What is this going to look like at the other end? And then what do we do when this is over and we can get kids back in the school to ensure that kids across the state have a good education?
Let's move on. Campaign fundraising figures for the second quarter of 2020 came out this week. Overall, leading Democrats outraised their Republican opponents. However, as we've discussed several times here on this program in recent years, money is only part of the equation. Share with us one campaign fundraising total that stood out to you and why. Rob?
Well, I don't have a specific candidate's total. It appears that the North Carolina Democrats are outraising Republicans by a wide margin. But, ultimately, I think this is a function of something we've talked about dozens of times. Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the factor in the 2020 election. There has never been a more motivated group of people than the people who are opposed to Trump and his policies. And that's not just Democrats. That's Republicans as well. That will be the dominating factor in this election. People find it unimaginable that we could suffer through another 4 years of Trump. And I think that is leading everybody in the direction that has been, or leading vast numbers of people in the direction of working to unseat him and those who would support him.
Well, to bring it here to North Carolina, the one that really struck me, and not a surprise, but it was the governor's race and how much money Roy Cooper has been able to raise. North Carolina is one of the few states in the country that is going to have a gubernatorial race. As a matter of fact, we're the only state in the country that has a U.S. Senate, all our congressional seats, a gubernatorial race, all of our legislative seats, all of our council of state races, and then, of course, our judicial races. So we really are kind of ground zero for this election. And so looking at the governor's race, it really stood out to me because I think it is sort of symbolic of all of those races and the importance of North Carolina in this election. He is tremendously outraised, his Republican opponent, Dan Forrest, with a lot of that money coming from out-of-state groups, out-of-state individuals. There's even a Broadway producer who has given money to the Roy Cooper campaign. And so I think that speaks to the national interest in North Carolina. And, you know, we'll see how that shakes out. I mean, I think certainly there could be an argument made that, you know, this is up to North Carolinians and we ought not be having a lot of people out of the state or out of the country participating in our statewide elections. But I think it also speaks to the point of this is a very important election, not only for North Carolina, but for the country. So if this will keep us in business through November, I think, because we come on every week and talk about politics. If you like politics, I think North Carolina is going to be a great place to be between now and November.
Yeah, I'll just say that in general, obviously, I've long argued that we ought to have public financing of elections, but I think that the cow's kind of gotten out of the barn when it comes to the donations coming from out of state. It's something that both parties have been making wide use of for years, and you know, sadly, that's the reality we face.
Finally, we'll turn our attention to Western North Carolina. The Asheville City Council voted unanimously for reparations for black citizens. The city also apologized for its role in supporting slavery and systemic racism. Now, these reparations will not include direct payments, but will provide funding for programs that are geared toward increasing home ownership and business and career opportunities for black residents. Do you think we're going to see other cities in North Carolina follow suit with similar kinds of programs, initiatives, or reparations?
You know, yes. And I think we're seeing it in the country. I think there's been a similar thing in Chicago and Evanston, Illinois, now Asheville. And we may see it in other cities in North Carolina, whether you call it reparations. And, you know, some of this comes back to semantics and messaging on this. And this is not something new. I mean, this has been discussed and talked about in different circles for years. You know, the problem that has come up with reparations. And Jeff, as you mentioned, this is not a direct payment from one group of people to another group of people. I think a lot of times when we hear that word reparations, the notion of, you know, cash payments being made to a certain group of people is what that means. That's not what Asheville has done. That's not what the other cities have done. What they have done is made a commitment to invest, and now there's no number amount of money that has been discussed. It's just, you know, they want to focus on ensuring that the black community has access to, as you mentioned, home ownership, job opportunities, investments in black-owned businesses, and those kind of things. You know, that, in my view, has long been the way that we make things equal for all individuals, and it's really doing it through philanthropic and through programs. When you get into the notion of reparations being paid by slave owners to people that were enslaved, you get into the, you know, because it was so long ago, there's the question of, I mean, who are those people in both groups? How do you trace that? And who is going to pay who and how much? And so this to me feels like, and I think that there's been a lot of research nationally done that this is the way to make things, to the extent that we can, but to ensure that things are equal and to invest in, again, the African-American community, to ensure that everybody has the same opportunities under the law.
Well, obviously, I think it's a fine start. It's a very nice action by the the city council in Asheville. But we hope it's only a start. This is obviously something that has been, as Becky said, discussed for a long time, but we haven't really gotten serious about it like we need to. There was legislation in Washington last year in the U.S. House that it was seriously considered to have to panel a federal commission to study this issue and to get serious about it. And I would argue that we should. It's not just dealing with the direct enslavement of individuals. There has a long history that followed in this country of direct, intentional discrimination by the government, both state, local, and federal government, against people of color. You need only go back and look at how housing discrimination took place in this country in the aftermath of World War II and how African-American families were redlined from the kind of wealth development that they might have developed. So just making our policies colorblind in the 21st century, to me, is not enough. I recognize there are lots of complexities in terms of how you would ever calculate how much would be an adequate reparation, how you could actually determine who's eligible for payments. There's a lot of complications to it. And like most American public policy that's made, if it gets that far, it'll be complicated and controversial and imperfect. But I think it's something that needs to be seriously explored, because we have this is not going to make things whole just investing in housing programs or, you know, minority-owned businesses. That's a nice start. But in terms of addressing the real depths of discrimination and the horrors that this country inflicted on people of color, I think we should get much more serious about reparations, real reparations.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Thank you both. Enjoy your weekend.
Have a good one, guys.
Have a great weekend.
The Week in State Politics drops each Friday in this feed. You can also hear a truncated version of the conversation on the radio, 4:50 Friday afternoons, during All Things Considered on WUNC. And don't forget to check out Tested. That's the relatively new podcast from WUNC. Dave DeWitt and Leonita Inge bring you that program now twice a week, and it's taking a look at both how North Carolina is responding to the pandemic, as well as how it is dealing with this racial reckoning happening across the country. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff, reminding you to subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify, wishing you a happy weekend, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Bye-bye!